Well, I'm here this morning with Dr. Paul Gordon Brown. He is a scholar, consultant, and speaker focusing on curricular approaches, student learning and technology, and social media and design. He's currently serving as the Director of Curriculum Training and Research at RoomPath, which focuses on residential student learning, which is what we're talking about today. So thank you for joining me.
Thank you for having me.
Great. Well, for folks that don't know what residential curriculum means or what it is, could you maybe run us down to about like what that is?
Yeah, absolutely. So residential curriculum, sometimes called now a curricular approach, really started in earnest a little over a decade ago. And what it attempts to do is take techniques that are utilized in the classroom, so things that K through 12 teachers have been using, also to an extent faculty on college campuses, and apply those curricular concepts into a residence life environment, or really a student life environment. That's part of that change. What started out of residence life as a residential curriculum kind of got expanded to all of student affairs work with kind of a nomenclature of the curricular approach. And so it really just means being intentional about what we want students to learn and then designing experiences that can help them learn that, which is a much more focused approach than some of the previous ones used in student life and in residence life.
So when you're thinking about developing curriculum for student affairs, student life, or specifically residential student housing, living, how do you start developing engaging and meaningful curriculum for students?
Yeah, well, there's a few components to it. So part of it is designing a curriculum. That includes all the nuts and bolts of how do I write learning outcomes? What should those learning outcomes be? How do I utilize rubrics, et cetera? And so for a lot of folks that work in student life, they may be generally familiar with those concepts, but maybe not to the depth that someone that was trained in teacher education might be. So there's certainly a learning curve on the mechanics of things. There's also some cultural changes. A lot of folks in student life and residence life, you know, have grown up through that system. They were probably involved students themselves. So they have this mental model of how it should be done and are used to replicating that model over and over again. And so when you come in and say, now we're going to look at things differently, that can really involve a cultural change or shift for those people and a mindset change. That is often the more difficult part of this process, is to begin to think about that differently. The nuts and bolts, you can teach that. People can learn that. It's a little bit more concrete, but thinking through how you change the way that you work can be incredibly difficult. There's also some organizational change aspects to that. Mm-hmm. Student life often has a tendency to take on more and more and more. So how can we be really focused in what we do and change some of those organizational behavior aspects? So those are probably the two prongs that come into this most. I think there's maybe a third one that I'd include in that, which is when you take a curricular approach as it's done in a controlled classroom environment and then translate it into a student life environment where things are optional, students come in and out, you're interacting with them differently. You don't have grades, you know, to measure learning. You don't have the same kinds of carrots and sticks to encourage learning. That also requires that the way that you teach and the methods that you teach are very, very different and have to be thought of differently because it's just not the same kind of controlled environment that you might have in a classroom. And so that requires you to really think about it differently.
Great. Well, that answer led me into about 10 other questions. So the first one being, kind of thinking about what you just said in terms of assessment and using different methods, and you're totally right, students are in and out. You may plan a curriculum that builds on top of each other, but a student comes to one of the three things, and so you're not sure if they've gotten the beginning, middle, end of the development that you had planned. How do you know if what you're doing is really leading to student learning?
Yeah. You know, assessment has been talked about in student life for years, but oftentimes what would happen is folks would design the program and then backfill it with learning outcomes after the fact. So here's what I want to do. Oh, and here's what students will learn while they're participating in it, rather than what is it I really want students to do, and then what am I going to design to do it. And so assessment was done, but in many cases it was more after the fact.
Right.
The other thing is, given that there was no structure to replicating things year over year all the time, that would also mean that you could collect assessment data, but then that event, that experience was not repeated again, and then you're not using your assessment data for improvement.
Mm-hmm.
And so one of the premises of utilizing a curricular approach in student life brings more regularity to that, that you would then plan this, you would then repeat it. You are already clear about what your learning goals and outcomes are before you even begin to design how you're going to teach that. And so that in and of itself makes the assessment more useful. It makes it more integrated into the work that students do. But you also have to think about assessment a little bit differently because, again, without that controlled environment that you sometimes have in the classroom, you have to rethink about what's going to work as an assessment and what's not. What could be authentic? You know, if I were to hold an event on campus and then administer a test at the end, that would be really awkward. So how can I think through that differently? Do I make it more of a fun style quiz that just happens to be a test that they don't even know? You know, are there certain things that I can do to collect data in the moment that doesn't look like that? So you also have to think about assessment a little bit more creatively, because some things that would work in a classroom environment would not necessarily work authentically in a more informal environment that you might find yourself in.
Would looking at the data sort of longitudinally be helpful also? So I think, for example, and again, this is, I spent a lot of time doing roommate mediations in residential life. So if some of your learning outcomes are around communication and conflict mediation, and you're measuring maybe how many roommate mediations you did 1 year, and then you applied the curriculum, and then you're measuring again the next year, did we have an increase or a decrease? Could that also be a fair assessment?
Oh, absolutely. And I think a lot of folks that work in student life don't necessarily do any kind of pre-test, post-test design
right.
In their work. Like, I don't see that as commonly occurring, but when I've gone on schools and consulted with them and I start talking about assessment, a lot of the light bulbs will go on and be like, hey, maybe we need to think about doing some kind of pre-test, post-test assessment or longitudinal, like let's make sure that we're looking at data that way. I think one of the difficulties that people often encounter is because they haven't been setting learning outcomes, because they haven't been doing it, they don't have baseline data always mm-hmm. to then compare against because they were never thinking about it that way in the first place.
Right.
So one of the things that I often encourage folks going down this path to do is think about what some of that baseline data may be. You know, how do you know that the curriculum is quote unquote working? You know, you have to compare it to something. And so what does that mean? Especially if you're comparing against something where the learning goals and outcomes were hazy to begin with, that makes it difficult.
Right, because then you're not really clear on what you're measuring. So you mentioned this earlier about there's the mind change and the nuts and bolts, but also creating some sort of system or structure to help your frontline staff that's really implementing, which in a lot of cases is our resident assistants and, you know, student paraprofessional staff and then graduate assistants and so on. What do you need to provide to those folks to make sure they're well equipped to deliver curriculum?
Yeah. Well, one of the essential elements of a curricular approach is that RAs or student staff members are important in the curricular process, but they're not necessarily leading that, which typically means, you know, they're not the ones setting the broad learning outcomes. What is it we want students to learn? They may have voice in that, but they're not trained in that. We don't expect them to do that. They're not going to go on to go into student affairs careers or teaching roles or things like that. And so not to place that burden on them, but focus more on the pedagogy of, you know, how do you facilitate a group conversation? How do you have an intentional conversation one-on-one with a student? And really focus on that skill and capacity building for the RA. I also think when we approach this, students are smart, and we need to, you know, recognize that, appreciate that, and include them in that. So even though students might not be responsible for writing learning outcomes, I want them to understand how they function. Mm-hmm. How is it the professional staff members are doing it? So that when they read them, they understand where these things are coming from. I think same thing with assessment principles. They don't really need to be doing the heavy analysis of that assessment, but they need to understand where they fit into the process and what the work that they do leads into the broader picture. And so giving them that appropriate context, teaching them even some student development theory, not that they need to be student development experts, but just so that they understand some of the basics that goes into it, I think can really help gain buy-in with the student staff members. And also help them understand and be more open to, oh, this is why I'm doing it, right? It's not just something my supervisor is making me do, but I can see how it fits into the overall picture and why this is important and what it leads to. So that can help a lot. That's part of also closing the assessment feedback loop, mm-hmm. bringing that data back to the RAs. So I had you collect all of this data, which maybe at the time seemed a little bit too much work, or I don't know why I'm doing this. As long as we're bringing that assessment data back to the student staff members, they'll see, oh, this is how it helps inform me going forward. So closing that loop and not just letting the assessment data sit on a shelf or go to an upper level administrator or made with internal decisions amongst the professional staff, but then never seen outside of it, can really help them understand where they fit into the process.
I think you're right that that's so key to have their buy-in, because certainly student staff, I'm going to use the word attitude about what they're being asked to do and deliver really plays a role in how the students receiving the information, how they buy in and participate. So if an RA is grudgingly leading a session, that sort of colors the session and the participation, and there's sort of that domino effect.
Yeah, and I see it as transparency in part. I have Marsha Baxter Magolda in the back of my head screaming learning partnerships and thinking about the way that we interact with RAs and how we want that to be a little bit more of a learning partnership, not necessarily a strict supervisory management type relationship. But really involving them in the process, because they're learning too. In some ways, we have our own curriculum for our student staff members that we want to achieve. So it all runs in parallel.
Yeah. Well, how do you know when it's not working? And how do you pivot and readjust?
Yeah, there's quite a few ways it can start not working. So let me think of a few of the more common ones that I've seen. In some cases, when folks go down this path, they stop short of embracing the entirety of the mindset change. Mm. Typically, what will end up happening is folks will get the mechanics. I need to write learning outcomes, set those out from the start. But then they go into a process where they continue to do what they've always done, which is, here's the outcomes RAs, now program around this. And so every RA is doing something differently. Mm-hmm. Different things are going on in different buildings. There's no consistency. Your assessment data then is still not useful. In the Institute on the Curricular Approach, we call that a highly developed program model with learning outcomes. So better than maybe just setting broad categories of events, but really doesn't embrace the full mentality. I think we often find that with schools that try to understand and cobble together a curriculum from what they find online and what they're reading, which only gives you a portion of it, doesn't really get at the mindset change portions as well as an in-person experience like the Institute does. But that's a pretty common one. Buy-in from staff is another pretty common one. It sometimes takes a few years to work through. Mm-hmm. So you may have staff members that just are not willing to give up their old model and their concept about what residence life should be and how that works. And so there's resistance. You might also get that from your student staff members, because change can be hard. That's pretty natural. It's natural that all schools will encounter some level of resistance on that, and then usually their curriculum will not be as robust as it could be. Oftentimes that just takes time and focusing on that. And so being cognizant of that, that organizational change is another potential hiccup.
Mm-hmm.
I think the final one, and the one that folks tend to struggle with, is also, since we've been talking about assessment, really understanding how to do assessment well, and what does that look like, and how do you use that assessment data, is something that folks that go down this path continuously say they always feel like they need to work on. Mm-hmm. I think assessment is one of those things that you almost always feel like you could do better at. you know, I don't know if anyone's like, yes, we're banging out of the park and there's not really much we need to do. You know, assessment changes over time. So it might be working well now, but changes, you know, maybe we need to adjust it in the future. So really figuring out how to meaningfully take that data and use it, mm-hmm. Is another area where I think folks tend to struggle or go off track with a curriculum.
I think this will probably be our final formal question. So thinking about our student affairs educators and their curriculum development and implementation, how do you encourage them to be creative and innovative, especially if they were more recently using one of these older wellness wheel models, or you know, do one social and one educational program a month and that's it? So how do you help them kind of move outside of the box?
One of the, when folks are resistant to a curricular approach, a common refrain that we hear when we go out to consult or even at the Institute is that a curriculum limits the creativity of the staff members. I don't believe that is true, but that is a common refrain that we hear, probably less so now actually than we used to. But the idea is, in the past, typically with older models, staff members could do whatever they wanted. They had complete rein to create whatever they wanted, maybe within some constraints, but usually they were pretty minimal. You have to create something in this topic, this super broad topic, but otherwise you can do whatever you want. And a curriculum, which is a little bit more prescriptive in that it's much more narrow in what we're trying to achieve, and design some things that says, this is what I want you to implement, that can feel like you're using less creativity, especially if you're the one executing it. I think you need to relook at how that word creativity is used, though. You know, if I were to teach a course at a college or university, and let's say it's a core course, I'm probably going to be given a common syllabus. Here's the things that students that take this core course need to know. How I teach that, how I add to it, I can be really creative about. But just getting the core curriculum outcomes and what students need to know does not necessarily limit my creativity, but it channels it in a different way. And so thinking about that word creativity differently is part of that, I think, challenge with staff members that might be resistant to giving up on that old model. It's a different form of creativity. It's asking you to be more creative in the method in which you're doing it, more creative in the pedagogy that you're using, even though it might not be you can do whatever you want. So creativity, to me, as a definition, has never been you can do whatever you want. But it's maybe when presented with a problem or an issue, thinking about different ways of solving it that may not have been thought of before, which is really what a curriculum is all about. Here's what we want students to learn. Here's the problem that we know students encounter that we want to solve and help them solve. You know, so how can we think creatively about how to do that?
That's great. I think in seeing the transition from my team at UCF, the students were initially like, oh, this is limiting our creativity. But then there was the reminder that, well, honestly, you would sort of wait till the last minute and rush to throw together a program or activity for your students. And you would rely on things that you've already done or something that had already been constructed for you. And you weren't really being creative. You were just, kind of falling back. And so now you have this plan, and the content is more prescribed, but exactly what you said. Bring yourself to it, bring different methods, think about how your students are, populations might be different. Maybe you have international students, so the way that you deliver content for them may be different than what you're delivering to more traditional first year students in a different community. And so really thinking about, I think, audience and meeting them where they are, and then method. And I honestly think that was probably the biggest flip for the students, was just really the intentionality and then how to be creative with meeting their students where they were.
Yeah. And I also, usually when I talk about strategies for working with student staff members and this kind of change, one of the things I repeatedly say is you need to figure out a way to validate your student staff members as knowers. Mm-hmm. You need to think about, you know, they're bringing stuff to the table as well. So one way I would talk to student staff members about it is to say, I will have expertise in student development theory, constructing, you know, learning environments, outcomes, things of that sort. But you're a peer leader that can connect with students in ways that I, you know, as a 40-year-old man cannot, mm-hmm. right? You are more in touch with what's popular, what's interesting. And so when you interact with a student, you're bringing that expertise. I'm relying on you to take what we've developed and make it engaging, make it fun, make it interesting in ways that maybe I won't think about. And that's really that peer mentor, that RA or that student staff member's expertise. And that's what we need. It's critical to the way that we do our work. And so if you can validate student staff members, and validate them as knowers and having an area of expertise, but you're kind of delineating where that expertise begins and ends a little bit, I think that can help you out a lot. Because rather than feeling like it's being imposed upon them, they feel like they're being brought into a process. And that's a key part of that change.
Great. Well, I think maybe just to close out our session, why should everybody move to residential curriculum?
It's the only way that we've come up with that's the most effective at hitting the outcomes that we need. Mm-hmm. And we all know that, you know, if you look at trends of higher education as a whole, in terms of greater calls for accountability from state governments, from the public, you know, demonstrate that what you do has impact. Funding decisions in terms of the money that the college universities receive is often now tied to that.
Right.
There's also declining support overall, period, which means that how do we do more with less? So how can we have the maximum impact on student learning while not running ourselves ragged, trying to do all these different things and do it in a much more focused and intentional way? So to me, given all the trends in higher education, it just pushes you in this direction. Plus gives you really actionable data to say, here's what we do and here's how it has impact. You know, folks on college campuses and student life didn't invent learning outcomes and curricular processes and things like that. They didn't create them, but they're used in a lot of different venues and they're successful in a lot of different venues. And many smart people have worked in developing these things over the course of years. So I think it would be kind of professional malpractice if we didn't look at those things and say, how can this apply to the work that we do?
Great. Well, thank you so much for your time this morning. If folks want to get in touch with you, what's the best way to track you down?
Yeah, so I use my full name, Paul Gordon Brown, PaulGordonBrown, for everything. So add at Gmail onto that, you get me. Go on the web and go to paulgordonbrown.com, you get me. Tweet at me at that handle. Put it at the end of Instagram, you'll get all my travel photos, anything you want. So if you use Paul Gordon Brown, pretty much attached to anything, it'll make its way to me.
Great, thank you so much.